The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.
Tonight on the programme, in the final year of the decade of centenaries, our panel will be looking at the celebrations, difficult conversations, painful recollections and indeed the upcoming challenges. We look at what the state and us, the public, have learned about ourselves from the 1913 lockout leading up to the events of the Civil War and events in between. And joining us tonight in studio are Katrina Crow, our archivist and broadcaster, Mary McAuliffe, historian and director of gender studies at UCD, Sinead McCool, author and historian for the commemorations unit and curator of MNA100.ie, and Professor Mike Cronin of Boston College and project lead for Century Ireland. And we do want to hear from you throughout our discussions this evening. So please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. We've done the easy bit. Arguably, we'll get through that, and now comes the hard bit, which we'll deal with later. But before we get into that, Katrina, you first. What's been done well, and by whom?
Well, I think when we started all this, which would have been around 2012, the beginning of the so-called decade of centenaries was the passage of the Third Home Rule Bill, which effectively would have achieved Home Rule after 30 years of fighting for it by the Irish Parliamentary Party. That, of course, was suspended on the outbreak of World War One. And then we go through a whole series of events, the 1913 lockout, as you mentioned, World War One, the 1916 Rising, the fight for female suffrage, the War of Independence and the Civil War, and loads of other stuff in between. So it was a rocky enough prospect at the beginning. And the government very cleverly established an expert advisory group of historians, librarians and archivists at the very beginning of the decade, who were there to give them guidelines on commemorations. I'm using the double click thing. I don't like the word commemoration. I think there is a place for it. But I think what was mainly engaged in during this decade was interrogation, reflection, analysis. And the reason we could do that was because we had the release of really significant archives, which had been kept locked up like radioactive items for a very right. long time, in case they might cause the country to explode if they had a look at them. And the two main archives classes that we got were the Bureau of Military History, which is the oral history of the revolutionary period up to the truce in 1921. Civil War was left out of it because it was, again, too toxic and radioactive. And the military service pensions files, which are much fuller and more interesting and go right up into the middle of the 20th century. These are claims for compensation by people who lost loved ones or who were wounded or disadvantaged by service to the country during the revolutionary period. So we had all of that, and we still have the military service pensions files being released, which meant two things: that scholars had access to this material in time for the anniversary. So the books like Roy Foster's Vivid Faces, for example, could be published in time for the anniversaries we were going to be going through. And two, that the public, because all this material is available free to access online, could look at the stuff themselves and make up their own minds about what had happened in their localities, to their ancestors, to the country at large. So it was a very good basis for how do we know what we know? One of the biggest questions we can ask these days, with the plethora of nonsense that we get on social media, where opinion supersedes fact a lot of the time, and where fake news is now a reality. So we have probably the best documented revolution in the world, and we've made very good use of those archives. That would be the most significant thing that we did well.
Right. And in terms of public events, Sinead, what do you think in terms of advertising that this material was available, in terms of engaging the public in events and focusing minds, what do you think the highlights were?
Well, I suppose I have to sort of say at the outset, I've been a member of the expert advisory group since the outset, so I've sort of feel in some ways that we're still in the centenary, and I'm sort of, this is the first opportunity to sort of step back and look at it. And I think where you look at major events, it was around communities. So obviously the archive would be an area. Obviously, as a historian, that I would be talking about, as that the access and how transformative that was, that, you know, there was no forced narrative. There was this multitude of narratives. There were a lot of people who did personal histories. They were able to look at the material in their own homes in their own time. And so when you came to the community events and the events that happened, you know, people will have standout events that were really well done. Like there were small commemorations. I remember Francis Ledwich in the cottage up in Meath was so moving, and his poetry was used, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and the cottages and the flowers were blooming, and the local, you know, volunteers and people who worked in that small museum were so engaged with this 100-year anniversary. And that was replicated Bannistrand. People, you know, spoke about how wonderful that was as an occasion. And I think a lot of people felt that they were looking again at their own history. And one of the things that people talked about the most was that in the schools, when they rolled out the proclamation day and they raised the flag and they read the proclamation, I spoke to a lot of people who were descendants of people who were in 1916 who felt that they had their moment. They read the proclamation, and then the filtering out from children to grandchildren, because so much work was done and has been over the last 10 years in schools, is that people who weren't engaged with the history, who would say, you know, I'm not interested in that, or I don't want to look at that. And I remember meeting women who had been married to Irish men, and they were always asking questions when they first arrived in Ireland, and they were delighted with this centenary, because they felt that they had access to information about Ireland that they had been asking for from the time that they'd been there. And that was one of the things I found really interesting, was their response.
That grassroots community ownership of history and people interrogating sources that are kind of not official sources, Mary, particularly in your area of gender studies and women's history and that kind of thing. How important was that in bringing a different flavour, things that hadn't been seen in previous decades, maybe to the fore?
I think it was very important when going around the country, as we were doing before COVID hit in 2020, and giving public lectures to local history societies all over the country. I saw parts of the country I'd never been to before, so that was a great experience as well. And a lot of the local history societies got money to host historians to come in. And every time I gave a talk about the women and the contribution of Cumann na mBan women, because locals had gone on the Bureau of Military History and gone on to the military pensions application files and found their grandmother or grandaunt or various people in their families, they shared their stories with me and with the audience when it came to questions and answers. But also those who were not on those records came up and talked about other aspects, the more probably darker, more traumatic aspects of what women experienced during this period, particularly violence against women, gendered and sexual violence during the revolutionary period, including the suffrage women who got pretty much chucked around as well when they were campaigning. But during the War of Independence and now on into the Civil War, but also sharing local stories that had been passed down through the generations that didn't make it into the main narratives of the revolutionary period, but were specific to local areas. And one woman in particular that I wrote a short biography of was Margaret Skinner, and her local area where her father had come from, just outside Monaghan, really commemorated her. They ended up doing a roundabout.
Is this the woman? She was a sniper and then ended up as a prominent teaching trade unionist?
Yes, she became president of the INTO in 1956. So, you know, trajectories of careers can be very interesting.
Her sniping skills probably came in handy as a teacher, yes, throwing chalk at recalcitrant pupils, yeah.
But they from the very beginning, they were determined to commemorate her. She herself was born in Coatbridge. She had written her memoir in 1917, one of the first eyewitnesses accounts, not just by a woman, but by anybody, of the Rising. And they named a roundabout after her. And then they created this amazing structure on by the side of the road in the middle of the countryside, right beside the cottage where her father had grown up. So they took real ownership of Margaret Skinner and her participation in the whole revolutionary period and shared that with me and invited me down to be part of that commemoration of her. And that happened all over the country.
You could imagine, though, maybe in previous decades, the totality of her life, there mightn't have been the same eagerness, given the life she lived, to commemorate
of it. One historian wrote about her that, you know, she's famously the one woman who's wounded in 1916. Then she goes off to America and she writes, "Doing my bit for Ireland." And then as this person wrote that she became a teacher and settled into a quiet life. She did nothing of the sort. She had an entire other life after the revolutionary period. She was anti-treaty, ended up in prison during the Civil War, and then becomes an activist with the INTO and participates in the famous teachers' strike, is president, campaigns to get rid of the marriage bar for married women teachers, equal pay for all teachers, men and women, and has this amazing life, but also this other life, which in doing my research, I discovered was that she shared her life with another woman. And those marginal histories were discovered as well through doing research on the whole revolutionary period.
Mike Cronin, I suppose the tendency for at the official level of commemoration to be nervous about Ireland's external relationships, primarily the relationship with Britain and events in the north. Was there any sense that the decade of centenaries was less affected by that this time round? And did, for example, the Queen's visit to the Garden of Remembrance allow the official telling of the history to be less nervous about that causing of offence, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I think the sort of whole choreographing of the Queen's visit was part and parcel of what was coming. So I think, you know, people in foreign affairs, people who kind of work in that world did figure out what the key relationships were. You also had just a confluence of dates. So you had, you know, the foundation of the Northern Irish state is, in terms of what 1916 was trying to do, a failure. Yet for the Unionist population, that's the beginning of their country. It's the fact that by the time you got into 2018, you're also hitting the 50th anniversary of the Northern conflict, the Northern Troubles starting. So there's lots of sensibilities around that. I think two things strike me. I think one thing that was touched on earlier is the fact the advisory committee sat there, was large, was well informed, and most importantly, was listened to. Mm. Really kind of, you know, things were red flagged as they went along. Nobody arrived at an event and got blindsided. Happened a couple of times, but by and large, the sort of the informed way this was done worked. I think also there's a distinction to make in the way I've watched this decade, I think we'd all agree on, is there's a difference between commemorative acts. So what we saw Easter Sunday 2016, those big set pieces which are about a moment, 100 years ago, wave your flag, bring your kids, it's a day out. And in a way, they're gone. You know, there'll be nice pictures, nice mementos, but they're done. I think the real legacy is the history or our collective understanding of history, whether it's family, community, whether it's diving into the archives. But it's a fact, as Katrina was saying, those archives were almost hidden away. During this process, they're given a vehicle to be released into the public domain. Digitization, the internet helps that. But they're there forever now. They're there for a resource. And that's happened on multiple levels, that things have come to light. New research, new ways of thinking about this period, new groups within this period. So I think there is that twin thing, that the commemorative aspect, when you put presidents and T-shirts into the public domain, were very kind of largely safely done, correctly done, didn't offend anybody unless they were prepared to take offence. But alongside that, we also have this much deeper historical legacy of both material but also the way people engage with what it meant to be alive 100 years ago, what their relatives did, what their town did. And I think that depth is really important.
That, Katrina Crowe, that depth that, you know, has been touched on throughout this. I mean, for years, World War I was regarded as a kind of a forgotten chapter in Irish history. But looking back on the centenary of commemoration so far, you look at something like the lockout. Was that arguably more forgotten because of who it affected and what it was trying to strive, and the fact that the villains of the peace were Irish people, and it wasn't part of the independence narrative, that there was an element of an inconvenient chapter about the lockout?
Partly. I mean, we have to remember some of the things that we think were forgotten weren't actually forgotten. women were not written out of Irish history to the extent that we've heard they were. Margaret Ward wrote on management revolutionaries in 1985. That's a long time ago. There's been a superb amount of good women's history, including from our two fellow panellists here, over the last 20, 30, 40 years. In terms of the lockout, the reason that we know so much about it now is because Porrig Yates wrote a magnificent, huge book about it that tells us everything we need to know about it, and that set the scene for the commemoration, stroke interrogation, stroke reenactment of it that happened in 2013. That was funded more or less by the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. And it was a very good practice run for a lot of what came after, including the stuff around World War One. Now, the whole business of World War One and its exclusion, if you like, from the Irish nationalist narrative was opened up over the last 40 years by people like Miles Dungan, John Horne. Kevin Myers was very active as a journalist in talking about the Irish involvement in World War One. So the ground was ready. The advantage of something like a series of anniversaries, such as what we've just been through, is that they bring focus onto topics and subjects and events that otherwise wouldn't get that kind of attention. There's also a kind of tyranny about it, because it's not impossible that now that we're done with this decade, everyone's going to forget about the 1913 lockout, the women's issues, 1916 rising, War of Independence, etc. We're sort of done with it. The archives are still there. They're still there to be exploited and interpreted and looked at in many different ways. And let's hope there isn't a tyranny of anniversaries operating in this case. But I think there was ground laid before this decade. Irish history is in very good health. And, you know, we should celebrate that. People want to read history books. They want to hear historians talking. They want to look at things like the magnificent Century Ireland that Mike has presided over for the last 13 years now, is it 12 years? That would be one of the great legacies too of the decade. So there was a genuine engagement with all of this, including with World War One, including with the difficult issues about violence towards women that wouldn't have been tolerated even 20 years ago as an idea. I mean, I'm old enough to remember 1966, when there was only heroic male idealism on display. It was all very impressive and moving and sad and elevating, but nothing about casualties, nothing about bereavement or death, certainly nothing about World War One and the huge depredations on Irish families that brought. So this time around, we've had a much better emphasis on those issues, including the trauma caused by conflict that can go on for generations after.
That is a point, isn't it, Mike?
One point, I think, as well, that it goes back to your previous question in terms of how much of this was kind of unforeseen. If you think about why does a lockout have such resonance? Why does the housing collapses in tenements in 1913 have such resonance in 2013? Mm-hmm. Ireland's just coming out of a catastrophic economic collapse in the contemporary terms, where people have, you know, emigrated, there's been poverty, the housing crisis, all the things that come out of that economic collapse. And suddenly, 100 years ago, people are facing the same struggles. And I think there's various events that you can sit there as a historian, this happened, this happened, this happened, but you have no sense of when you hit the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the Northern Irish state. We're in Brexit land. We don't even know where the border is between Britain and Europe and Ireland and Europe anymore. And suddenly the idea of celebrating that state, commemorating it, has a contemporary resonance. So I think that, again, is why certain of these things were sort of dragged forward and had much more prominence and resonance to people now than maybe they might have done.
We even saw, Mary, a surprising resonance with people who had been pro-Brexit in the UK quoting 1916, and even Michael Collins on occasion back to Irish people. There was resonance in surprising parts of the globe, maybe.
Oh, yes, I would say so. And using those resonance, of course, happened in not just in Brexit, but, you know, in the two referenda that happened during in the decade of centenaries. And, of course, commemoration is always bound up with contemporary politics and who gets commemorated and what things are seen as more important today in this 100th anniversary that weren't in 1966. And obviously, as Katrina said, it was the dead male patriots that were the centrepiece then. But, you know, we had the marriage equality referendum in 2015 and repeal in 2018. And
you see that as another revolutionary period commemorating an earlier one.
Yes, you know, and in many ways. And lots of people felt resonances of this being maybe a radical decade. And of course, we had no idea what was coming down the line in terms of this alt-right backlash and Brexit and the rise of conservatism, and very far-right conservatism in many ways. But it also meant that there is now a freedom to interrogate other narratives, more marginal narratives of the revolutionary period, which many historians are doing and which is very interesting. And the records bring out that as well. So it'll be very interesting to see what the next generation of historians do. They will now have access at the start of their careers to all of this material in all of its complexity and all of the inclusion events and inclusions in it, and what they will make of that material, because I think they'll be writing very interesting, very complex and different histories.
And at a very young age, Sinead McGould, because history is less just a taught discipline in schools, mm-hmm. discoveries of the people are dealing more with primary sources in schools. Students are better equipped to engage in the ways that you were talking about, you know,
no,
communities engaged throughout the decade of commemoration.
I think what it is it is a more complex history, and it's different interpretations. And now within education and schools, there's, you know, this different ways of learning. And so now there's a whole move for historians to even present in a way which is curated films and curated material and interpret the material. So, you know, the idea of Century Ireland, for example, you know, rolling it out as things were happening. So that was a really good format. So you don't know what's going to happen next. And that was very appealing to younger people in a learning capacity, because you explain to them about the key thing that historians always bang on, and which is context, context, context. And so, yes, of course, as Mary has said, the importance of, you know, making those links and all of the interconnections. I think what's interesting being an RTE is when you think about, you know, somebody like Margaret Skinner, she was still around in 1966. She was recorded. We have her firsthand accounts. So she was known to her contemporaries in a period of time. It's like, We pull certain people out. But as Mary explained, the idea of the local and the taking the possession and the importance of the local historian and the information that was for the national history that was on a local basis, we had a system where the Decade of Centenary is running for 10 years with local coordinators. So run by the local authorities, having a Decade of Centenary coordinator on the ground with the fund in order to fund it whichever way that local community wanted. So whether they were going to do a play or whether they were going to do something else. And one of the people that I thought was really interesting, and there was a great interest around her from the veterinary community, was Aileen Custis, the first veterinarian. And they had a major conference last summer in Galway, but alongside that they had a podcast that they had instigated themselves. They had a workbook for schools, and they also had exhibitions about, you know, related farming and other activities. So what we found was that there were groups of people in different organisations and societies who had an opportunity to get small bits of funding in order to be able to do their own history and the wealth of material and the creation. So sometimes you feel, because you're so close to it, that you have a real sense of what has happened. But I think when you think about the way in which information is disseminated now and where it goes across, and the interesting thing was how it happened internationally. So there was an opportunity for us to actually engage with, you know, people who had been successful abroad, but also people who were, so down to the parish, down to the townland, right out to the world.
Before we leave 1916, we'll come back to it briefly after this. Let's hear from people recounting their own recollections of the Rising at the time. And this is from British filmmaker Robert Key's programme, Ireland, A Television History. And here's Paddy Butner. He fought for the Irish Citizen Army in the Rising at the age of 16. And he remembers being told the death of the leaders of the Rising at Kilmainham Jail while he was being held in Richmond Barracks.
When we were there and the soldiers were coming in and out, and three men was pierced and some of the others were shot on the 3rd of May, we were told the three buggers gone today. And we could actually hear a slight shooting, you know, from the distance. Kilmainham wasn't too far away from where we were. And then when Connolly was shot, and we were told, we knew he was wounded because the men that was with him told us. and he was put in an armchair, put in a car, brought up to Kilmainham from Dublin Castle, put down and shot in the armchair because he couldn't stand up. Well, it was very sad that day.
Now, on that same programme, Joseph Sweeney recalled being sent to the GPO to fight alongside his former headmaster at St Andrews, Pádraic Pearce, and he started by telling what mood Pearce was in when he first arrived at the GPO.
Well, he was rather pensive, you see. Connolly was laying on a stretcher right beside him, and Plunkett was there also, Joseph Plunkett, and he had a lot of bandages around his neck. He was TB, I think he had glandular surgery or somewhere. And there were several others of the leaders, and being a book private, I didn't want to get too involved there. So he told me that some of my company was up on the roof and I'd better join them. And I didn't see him again then until the end of the week.
What was the end like for you at the post office? And describe carrying Connolly, if you would.
When I reported after my sleep in the loft, Jim Ryan got hold of me and said, I have a job for you. And he took me in and showed me Connolly on the stretcher and said, you take that corner, which I did. And then he said, lift. We lifted and we tried to make our way up the stairs, which was very narrow and very steep. And to get the stretcher then onto the next flight, we had to lift the back end of it to as far as our arm would extend.
And that was Joseph Sweeney recalling being sent to the GPO. Katrina, at the outset, you were talking about the Bureau of Military History and the pensions records as well. While they're thankfully recorded as audio interviews, there are some very rich accounts of people's lives during the revolutionary period and how they were involved in that. Is there an argument for bringing some of those resources to life in terms of voicing them and the like to make sure that people can access them who may...
Well, it's been done. I mean, one of the things we haven't yet discussed is the arts programme for the decade, which was superb, and particularly in terms of drama. And two things stand out for me. One was Pals, the story of the Irish in Gallipoli, done by Anu Productions, who are our best site-specific theatre company. That was the story of a young group of rugby players who all joined up together to join the British Army in 1915 and ended up in Gallipoli, where half of them were murdered, killed on the first day. And it's an astonishing story of set in the very dormitory in the what was the Royal Barracks, that is now the National Museum, Collins Barracks, where they slept when they were being trained there in 1915. So incredibly resonant. People came and we had five performances a day. I was involved in this and I had the privilege of working with Anu for a few productions they did. People would come to see this and leave weeping. And it was very cathartic in terms of the emotional pull that you could have with drama that doesn't come any other way. But the other thing that I can now, I hope, say that will be available to everybody is staging the treaty. The treaty debates over Christmas of 1921-22 were the most important conversation we ever had with ourselves. And they were staged before Christmas over four nights in the very room in Eresford Terrace where the original debates took place, again by Anu Productions. Cast of 45, all the key players, De Valera, Collins, Griffith, etc. Incredibly moving, went under the radar because it was before Christmas, but luckily it was filmed. And the film now has found a home, I hope, in the Irish Film Institute, where people will be able to watch it when it's been re-edited and captioned and all the rest of it. And I would urge everyone to look at this because it is the most educational and moving and heartbreaking experience you will have about a country sliding inevitably into civil war. They cannot hear each other at a certain point towards the end of these debates. And you also, people have to ask themselves, what side would I have been on? Would I have been pro-treaty because I wanted an end to war and destruction, as most of the country did? They voted overwhelmingly for the treaty in June of 22. Or would I stand by the Republic, so-called, and refuse to take an oath to the King? One of the things we didn't really discuss during this decade was religion. You know, I think one of your questions is, what wasn't really explored. Religion is not a cool subject for discussion at the moment for various reasons, but religion permeates every aspect of our decade of centenaries.
And are we in danger? Are we in danger, in the modern era, with, I suppose, the lesser role it now plays in life, of forgetting what a potent force it was in society?
We are in danger of doing that. And it's really important that we don't, because one of the complaints that many of us around this table would have is that this became a confessional Catholic state after the revolution was over, when we got our independence.
Mike Cronin, I suppose that what we were always taught in history in school was that when the Northern state was set up, it became a Protestant parliament for a Protestant people. But the flip side of that was also true south of the border, and most of the population wasn't uncomfortable with that.
No, they weren't. I mean, again, that's the problem with the decade of centenary, is it has to end. Therefore, you know, there's a cut-off in October 2023 and we're done.
Is there anything to be said for another decade?
There is in a way, but I mean, I think what it leads into what Katrina was just saying, and your question about the creation of a Catholic state, that you have this period which is understood, not solely, but as a period of kind of complete political upheaval that creates two states on this island. But what's amazing is how in this state we go from a kind of very radical and inclusive view of what Ireland might be in 1916, and actually what is unleashed on the world from 1923 is a regressive, backward-looking Catholic state that contains its own people, particularly women, and carries on with that abusive way of being for 80 years, 90 years. And in a way, by forgetting religion and forgetting what actually the island that is created, we do a disservice about how we've had this conversation.
Well, I think we also have to remember that quite a lot of the people we think of as radical revolutionaries were quite devout in their own spiritual life, whether they're Catholic or Protestant. At the moment, I'm looking at the diaries of Kathleen Lynn, and she dates each day, each Sunday, with the Sunday it is according to the religious calendar. And she is a devout Anglican, and her partner is a devout Catholic, and they talk about their religious practice all the time. But also there was the sort of politicization of religion, or the use of it as a protest, with women saying mass rosaries outside jails where men were being held prisoner, and other women were being held prisoner. When Law on the Mon happened, anti-conscription campaign in 1918, they marched round towns and then ended up in churches to say rosaries. And so all the time you come across this, and it is something, actually, you're right, we didn't really discuss how religion is so much part of their world in a way it isn't part of our world today. So it's very easy to not think about it. And also because of what we've been through in terms of our own relationship as a community, as a nation, with our dominant religion over the last 20 years, perhaps it's something people don't want to think about and don't want to engage with.
And it was relevant.
But it does dominate our state.
And it was relevant as an unseen force as well, because I suppose the template through which martyrs were exalted, going right back to O'Donovan Rossa, was drawing on the Irish devotion to martyrs and saints in the first place, something that was greatly misunderstood by the Crown forces in Ireland.
Yeah, I suppose when I look at, when you were talking about not being looked at in religion, I'm thinking about, you know, different things that I was involved in. So we had where the Manon 100 site came from was the women's programme, or the women's strand. And one of the things where we looked at was the White Cross, for example, and the distribution of the money came through the parish system. You know, when you look at, let's say, devotion. So there's a recent piece that we did in January where we looked at violence against women, where Lindsay and Byrne looked at a letter in detail. We did a masterclass, a small film on a letter by this woman called Mary M, who's written to the Archbishop. She's looking for money because she's become pregnant because of a rape. And in that letter, in the analysis, is her devotion and her reaction to what has happened to her is against the backdrop of the fact that of her Catholic religion mm-hmm. and how she is going to be seen as in, you know, the term of the time as a fallen woman. And mm-hmm. it's only seen in that context. And it's a really a way. So when you look at the actual source material and you're looking at it and you're not excluding something, and you'll see the same thing in the Century Ireland where you're reporting at the time, it's there all the time. It's ever present. So it's when we're writing it in, again, this is back to the context piece. If you're writing something with context, it's there and it's very clearly there and it underpins so much of what's happening. But it's also the strength of that. But one of the interesting books that came out in the early stages was Rebel Prods, which was written about how many Protestants, because when we were growing up in school and in Catholic schools, they talked about religion. And one of the reasons in the early stages why religion was so important in terms of the museum's collection, it was put together by Nellie Gifford, who in fact herself was Church of Ireland, uh-huh. but she put it together originally, the museum's 1916 collection, for the Eucharistic Congress, because there were going to be so many visitors to Dublin. So sometimes that's why there were so many religious objects on display, and then they come out and new material comes to light and new collections are brought together and they change some of the material that goes on display. And yes, it's changed some of the ways we've displayed material. Maybe some of the religious material isn't to the fore, but partly that's because people found other new materials and new mm-hmm. new material to show.
I guess I'm talking about ideology and mm-hmm. power mm-hmm. rather mm-hmm. than objects.
But that is a complex legacy, isn't yeah. it, Katrina? Because you've got it as a social force that provides free education
Absolutely.
To people, it provides healthcare, it provides all of those other things, and yeah. yet through that it incrementally reached its hand into the power structures of society. And the other side of that was the things we unpicked in the 1990s, yeah. the legacy yes. of yeah. that unquestioned power.
No, I couldn't agree more with you. But what I'm saying is that we haven't had a really philosophical discussion mm-hmm. about the power of Catholicism as part of the revolutionary impulse, the pietism, the religiosity mm-hmm. that underpins a lot of what was written by everybody involved. And Mary has pointed to Protestant iterations of that sort of thing. We need to look at that, because where do the power of ideas come from? In Ireland, a lot of them came from the Catholic Church, and they inspired people to martyrdom, to all sorts of stuff, some of which you might say were counterproductive in all kinds of ways. And certainly the way that the state was run, as Mike has pointed out, after 1922, we didn't have mother and baby homes until 1922. There was suddenly an opportunity to do something new, to oppress so-called fallen women and their children. And let's not forget the industrial schools, which were a hangover from the British administration, but which we kept going much longer than they did in Britain. There's a funny impulse going on here that has been analysed in some ways in terms of the commissions of inquiry into all of this that we've had to listen to for the last 20 years and break our hearts in terms of what was done. But we need to go back and look at the original instincts here. And we need to talk about political legitimacy and democratic legitimacy as ideas from that period.
Okay, well, hold that thought, because we're going to have to take a short moment of reflection in keeping with our religious theme. We'll be back after this short break.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE.
Welcome back. You're listening to a Late Debate special on the decade of centenaries. Professor Mike Cronin, to you first on this. What kind of choices were made by the state is worth looking at, and why? I mean, we've been given to understand that it was a state with few resources and fewer choices, and that's why so much power was handed over to, for example, the Catholic Church. Is it worth interrogating some of the choices that were deliberately made by the state, everything from the economic model of self-sufficiency it chose and how that further perhaps limited its choices, why the decisions were made and why it became the state it became?
I mean, I think this goes back to the point of, you know, the spirit with which the decade of centenaries, the things we've talked about, be it archives, be it local studies, be it people kind of dealing with family, with individuals from the past. It's that impulse that needs to continue, even if you don't call it a decade of what happened next, mm-hmm. because those kind of changes that are there, that you go through the end of the First World War, Ireland is clearly going to break away from Britain in some way. Everybody is then looking for the next play, and the play is about power, first of all. Who's going to have power? The church ensures it, has it. There's a civil war, but you know the result's only really going to go one way. So you kind of know what the state is going to look like, who will hold power. But then it is that idea of how they're restricted by such vast kind of external forces. Who are you going to trade with? Are you really still trading with empire? There's a world recession coming 6 years later that nobody knows about that destroys the Irish economy, so exposed. So it is those kind of choices are quite interesting. I think, again, one of the big impulses I certainly found that when you look at the period and you read the material from 1919, 1920 onwards is just a sheer level of fatigue. Mm. You know, First World War, Revolution, Dublin destroyed, then from 1919, large parts of sort of Munster destroyed, death, illness, sexual assault, everything that goes with that kind of level of the sheer military presence. That you do, I just get that sense of people want a way out. And you get the idea that 22 into 23, 24, the state starts functioning. They're almost left with a blank canvas, you know. What should this be? And the idea they had in 1916 seemed a long time ago. And so much has changed. And they've really got to start kind of planning out sort of on a hoof almost, because there isn't, it's not like the American concept where you have that kind of Declaration of Independence, clear statement of intent, and they kind of hold that going forward. The Irish state almost arrives at a point of conception where it almost doesn't know what it is.
And, like they even forgot about the democratic programme, but the First Soil, which is the next big human rights document that we get after the 1916 proclamation, which is very aspirational.
Yeah.
So that gets lost. Mm. But a lot of this can actually be laid at the door of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. No country
should
ever
explain the democratic programme for anybody. It was drawn up in part to build a coalition of both the citizen army and the revolutionary forces in 1916. It's part of that.
Well, it was written by Tom Johnson, who was the leader of the Labour Party, a very interesting man, then watered down considerably by Sean T. O'Kelly from Sinn Féin, because even at this stage, they're starting, this is 1919 when they're setting off on their magnificent journey towards independence, they realise that some of this is far too radical. You know, the 1916 proclamation was too radical for the people who were allegedly fighting for it. We have to remember that this was a conservative revolution. Mm. And when they get into power, as Mike says, they have certainly a blank canvas to some extent, but they also have the entire apparatus of the British administration, mm-hmm. including its court system, its workhouses, its hospitals, mm-hmm. all of this. What are we going to do with this stuff? They have to, and the administration itself, the civil service, which is an interesting study in its own, which has been done. What happens to the Irish civil service after 1922? Who stays? Who goes? What do they do? So there's endless discussion to be had about this. But it is interesting that the two foundation documents were honoured more in the breach than the observance.
And going back in a way to the religious point, poverty as a virtue by the state is part of the excuse making for why it has the resources or why it doesn't have the resources it has to look after people. And some of the problems of the state are masked by emigration.
Oh, absolutely. And it'll be very interesting when we get a look at the 1926 census. And that will give us an awful lot of information about what happened in those first number of years of the Irish Free State. Obviously, they couldn't take a census in 21 because the war was going on. And we have the 1921 census in the other parts of the UK, which are giving bits of information already. Interestingly, unlike here, that census is behind a paywall. And I think that's a really interesting facet of our decade of centenaries. All this material is freely accessible. So the 1926 census will give us a sense of who's immigrating, how many are immigrating, who's left in the country. And if you look, for example, at the rolls of Cumann na mBan, which I've done in the military archives, and so many of them in the 1930s, 40s and 50s, when they're applying for their pension and the local branch leader was asked to give a list of who was in that branch of Cumann na mBan, and it's Mrs. So-and-so in the UK and the USA. So many of them have left in many ways because Ireland was no country for them. They were anti-treatyites. They were women. And in many ways...
Were they anti-treatyites because they were because they rejected the oath of allegiance so much, or did they see something else about the need to continue the other bits of the revolution against other forces they had felt in their lives, forces of oppression that weren't necessarily the Crown?
I think when they had their convention in February of 1922, it was the Oath of Allegiance that was the main sticking point. They did talk about the border and other aspects, but the Oath of Allegiance to a foreign monarch, as they saw it, and that repudiation of their oath to the Republic, which they felt was the primary oath that they had taken to fight this fight for Irish freedom. They couldn't do that. They couldn't supersede that oath. And see themselves taking the Oath of Allegiance. Not all of them now. Some of them do become pro-treaty and join Cumann na Saoirse. But it's interesting that, you know, the Civil War, the violence stops mainly by May 23, although in places like Kerry, it continues on. And for instance, I saw recently a report in a newspaper, W.T. Cosgrave comes to visit Tralee in August of 23, and he's met with a huge protest about Ballyseedy. Mm-hmm. Women carrying coffins, some relatives of men who were killed at Ballyseedy and the other massacres. And so this is an ongoing thing. This isn't immediately forgotten and put aside. This is an ongoing thing that will impact on into the next years.
And that kind of protest, Sinead McCool, and rightly so, around this time, 100 years ago, a member of Cosgrave's personal bodyguard was implicated in the extrajudicial killing of Bobby Bonfield at Newlands Cross. And Tom Johnson, who was mentioned, raises it in the Dáil. The government denies it flat. There's a series of articles run in the Irish Times called Dublin Murders. The proceedings of the coroner's court are there. People are almost identifiable, and yet we'll never be able to drill into some of those activities because the archives, while it's rich in some areas of Oriel House and the Criminal Investigation Division of the police that were located there, have been burnt and shredded. They're gone.
Yeah, I mean, we were dealing a lot of the time with oral history, and we're dealing a lot with accounts, but then a lot of families said nothing as well. So not only have we lost the official record, but we've also lost the narrative and the people. And they decided, they took a decision that if they had to stay in a very small country, when Carlton Younger came over to write his Civil War book in 1968, surprising a lot of people that we had had a civil war. He basically said that the reason it was so toxic and difficult in Ireland was because it was such a small population, it had touched so many families. So you can look at it at one stage and say it's a loss of records. And in British archives, they have a better record of keeping, the material and putting it under lock and key. But in Ireland, they decided that they wanted to continue on and live and relate to each other. The interesting thing that we're going to now is this, this post-revolutionary lives. And while we don't have a lot of the detail that you're talking about there, the military record, the pension record, has thrown up so much information about the social, political and economic history of our country that we're really still processing it and making sense of it. And so people are rediscovering the family stories, and then they're finding private archives. I can't get over the amount of private archives that are still there that are still going to come to light in the next 10 years. And every single time we go out and we do something like this, somebody out there says, and decides, planning to do it maybe for years, decides to go to an archive or a local library. And that's back to the importance of the local. Now the local librarian and the local archivist and all of them are welcoming people. For years, people didn't think that their story mattered. They were suppressing it and not wanting to discuss it. And I think when we look at the Civil War and what Mary described, and is that importance of the census record, the alternative pieces that we have, the Beyond 2022 is a way that has been put through the decade of centenaries to look at archives that are missing, and we still have opportunities to fill in the blanks and to still fill in the stories. And that's what the great thing is about the decade of centenaries has been, that to understand us as a people.
Mike Cronin, the difficulty though for the state of this and the narrative is ultimately Ireland became a democracy, and there's much made of how long that democracy lasted. But at the outset in the state, things like extrajudicial killings, the fact that the state was being told there is no legal underpinning for some of the executions you're carrying out, like the reprisal executions, the fact that there were forces within the state that maybe didn't dissipate until the army mutiny later on, that it wasn't just anti-democratic forces on one side in the anti-treaty forces and the democratic forces of the state. There was a push and pull between democratic and anti-democratic within the new administration itself.
There is. I mean, there's real problems throughout the 20s about how you kind of move away from a civil war situation, especially if you look at 23, 24, the thousands of people who are actually in prison. Mm-hmm. I mean, vast numbers are behind bars in camps, etc. You know, that question of how do you take the gun out of society, that doesn't just mean the people who last hand over their guns. As you say, you've got to extract a machinery that's been built within the state to murder people for political gain. That you don't just lock a door and close up shop. That's got to be unwound. And I think that goes back to lots of issues around trauma, about memory, about how politicians spoke to, or rather didn't, to their recent experience. I mean, I suppose that the amazing thing when you kind of move forward is the fact that by 1932, the losers win the election and you get a peaceful handover of power. You know, if there's one moment where Ireland sort of moves on from its condition, mm-hmm. it's that fact that within a decade you can switch from loser to winner and nobody takes up the gun again. But I think the thing is the idea of what you're dealing with. Again, I mean, the island's been partitioned. You have a Protestant Unionist state in the north that you've got to live next door to. I don't know what kind of relationships you're going to have to it. You've got to figure that out. You've got to figure out a new relationship with the UK. And in all those three-way partnerships, relationships that are building within the previous decade, going backwards from 1923, every one of those groups is militarised. The Irish, the Northern Irish, the mm-hmm. Unionists, as it were, the UVF, the British, definitely. That you've really got to unravel just personal trauma and political trauma.
Well, on that point of trauma, Catherine, the idea of how it affected individuals differently, some people stayed resolutely revolutionary. But in the case of Sean Lamass, who had several traumas, he had shot his own baby brother as a young man. He had lost his brother to an extrajudicial killing in the Civil War, and he had seen the rising. And by the 60s, he becomes a pragmatist. He's done with the visionary end of things. He just wants to make the state work, and he can do business with the unionists, possibly that nobody else was prepared, business that nobody else was prepared to do at the time.
Come the hour, come the man. I mean, he was the right man for the right time. You've got your moment, small moment of prosperity in the 1960s. He's Taoiseach from 59 to 66. Mm. So he presides over the 50th anniversary of the Rising, but he never talked about it. Mm. He wasn't interested in discussing it, what role he played in either the Rising or in the War of Independence. And you're perfectly right, that trauma of his younger brother and his brother Noel, who was killed up the Dublin Mountains in atrocious circumstances. Mm-hmm. Those traumas remain. And one of the interesting things about the sort of research that's happening now is an interest in trauma. A lot of the military service pensions files tell us that people like, say, Charlie Dalton, the brother of Emmett Dalton, who was one of Michael Collins's squad, who shot soldiers or intelligence officers on Bloody Sunday morning in Dublin, ended up severely mentally ill for most of the rest of his life. And there are many other examples of that. Mm-hmm. At a time when people didn't know what PTSD was, we had a country full of people suffering from it for various reasons to do with conflict. And it's why it's really important that we do that in the face of what was really a blithe acceptance of political violence as a way to get what you want in this country for a long time. That's what we were celebrating for a very long time, including on the 50th anniversary of the Rising. So we need to look at that. Sheafra Aiken has written a really interesting book about trauma from the material that she's got from the military service pensions files. We'll be at this for a long time, and that's a good thing. It's great that we can actually keep at this for as long as we probably can.
Unfortunately, we can't keep at it tonight because we've run up against the clock, but there's definitely a strong argument for having you all back for another programme looking at some of the aspects we've discussed. And I think it's possibly a strong argument again for another decade of centenaries, maybe running from the foundation of the state to the early years of the 1930s. We'll be back after this.